And welcome back. Once again, for those of you who are just joining in, this is Our Voices, and this is a special 10-part limited series. And this week, we're in episode 6 of this radio show that we have going. And once again, tonight, we have Harley Delarone and DeLuisa De Deer, who are in with us in studio. And we're going to be continuing our conversation, which initially had started just as one of the episodes, which grew now into episode 3 that we have them in for. And it's been some really interesting discussions. A lot of the feedback that I'm getting in from people who've been listening in have been that they've really been enjoying listening to the conversations and the discourse that's been happening. And so tonight we're going to be once again looking at our history, and primarily we're going to be focusing in more on the 1600s, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to be looking at that time era. And the interesting thing, as we were discussing prior to getting started here tonight, was that some of the things that we see, even almost 400 years later, we're still doing it, you know, almost 500 years later. Some of the things that our old timers were doing way back then, we're still continuing that tradition today. So it'll be interesting to hear, because DeLuisa De has selected some pieces out of one of the oldest journals that we have within our history of when we had Europeans who came to our territory and who were writing the things that they were seeing, and they were really analyzing our world at that time. So it'll be really interesting to hear. And we're going to be kind of looking at it and having a discussion here on what are our thoughts on it. And hopefully those of you who are listening in will be able to kind of have your own discussions too on, well, what exactly was it? What were they talking about? And what was the reasoning behind what it is we're going to be looking at tonight. So I'll hand the mic over to DeLuisa De, and he can just give a background explanation on the book we're going to be reading from.
Sure. Okay. Well, the book is called Journey into Mohawk and Oneida Country. It's based upon a journal of a Dutchman who came into Mohawk territory in 1634. It's actually three guys. The man writing the journal, his name is Herman van der Bogart. A little piece of trivia here is some people believe that Humphrey Bogart is a descendant of this Herman van der Bogart. Anyway, you know, just a little bit of trivia.
So okay. We have a link to Humphrey Bogart.
We touch everything.
Throw in one of the lines.
And he's accompanied by two other guys. One guy's name is Geronimus Delacroix, and the other guy is William Thomason. And they're young guys, probably in their 20s. But van der Bogart was actually a doctor. But he was, they were hanging around before it was Albany. It was a Dutch fort, right?
Fort Orange.
Fort Orange, yeah.
Yeah.
And so these three guys were tasked with basically fortifying trade relations with the Haudenosaunee.
Because now this is after that whole Turo thing had happened, right? And part of it was trade, right? Setting up trade with these Dutch.
And you know, some people will say that the Turo was the ground rules before trade could actually be established. So basically in December of 1634, these three guys make their way from Albany into Mohawk territory. I think they get as far as Oneida country, but while they're in Oneida, they speak with delegations from Onondaga and maybe Cayuga, I don't remember, but definitely Onondaga and Senecas. So anyway, they head out in probably the worst time in December into going to Mohawk territory. And they spend maybe 2 months making their way, almost 2 months, making their way through each community and talking to the people there. And the journal that he keeps, he keeps track of everything he sees. He talks about how many longhouses are in a village, how many people are in a village, what are they eating, what are they hunting, what are they trading. So it's such a rich source of information. Of course, you have to look at it with the lens of, you know, you have to be kind of cautious of the information.
Some of the terminology they might use.
So you got to kind of look at it critically, and then use your own judgment to kind of interpret what
were they
seeing.
Going with an agenda of any kind? Maybe not, but still, they're looking at it from their eyes. From
yeah,
their
Yeah, I'll say there's nothing really derogatory that they're saying, but sometimes it's a little bit hard to, if you're looking through their eyes, it might seem familiar to us what's happening, but to them, they're like, we don't know what's going on. So the idea today was just to look at certain parts of that journal, and I'll read a couple of lines, and then maybe we could talk about what we're reading, and see if you guys have any impressions about what we're reading.
Yeah, for sure. And once again, to our listeners, engaged as well. If you're hearing something tonight, and you might, have questions about it, just to kind of get that engagement, because this is really a glimpse into our past. Going back.
This is probably the first record, non-native record, of people going into Mohawk territory.
Into the valley.
Yeah. So, want to start?
Yeah. All right. As well. Let's go.
Okay. So here's the first one. This takes place on December 13th, 1634. So it says, in the morning, we went together to the castle over the ice that had frozen in the waterway during the night. Of course, when they say castle, they're talking about a palisaded village. When we had gone 1 mile, we came into their first castle, which stood on a high hill. There were 36 houses, row on row, in the manner of streets, so that we easily could pass through. These houses were constructed and covered with the bark of trees, and most were flat above. Some are 190 or 80 steps long and 22 to 23 feet high. There were also some interior doors made of splint planks furnished with iron hinges. In some houses, we also saw ironwork, iron chains, bolts, harrow teeth, iron hoops, spikes, which they steal when they are away from here. I guess that's an assumption. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. But, I think we talked about it briefly the other show. It's 1634, and these longhouses already have iron hinged doors with plank doors.
I would think there had been training well before that,
yeah,
but not in an official sort of a sense where you're allowed to. And don't forget, some of our people knowing that they had gone to places like where Manhattan is and so on, there's a real possibility that many of our people had ventured in that area too.
Yeah.
And, what would be the kind of trade items they would really be most interested in, that would be interesting.
There's actually a reference later on that talks about if they could ask these guys to pass a message to the chief of the Manhattans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they obviously had our people had ventured in that area.
But you think about it too, and it's this whole idea we were talking about before, where this adaptation, right? They had this new way of coming in, and they must have seen it as, hey, this is going to make things a lot easier for us, so we might as well trade for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea of, like, trade at that time and how far out the Haudenosaunee were impacting, even with trade. There's stories of us being all the way out into the Mississippis, Illinois,
Kentucky.
Really, Kentucky, which I've heard a theory about Kentucky, where that word comes from.
Yeah.
And... when you hear the people say Kentucky. Well, you just say Gundagai.
Yeah.
And
it's the anglicized way of saying Gundagai.
Yeah, which is on the plains, You go out to Kentucky and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But if you look at, you could probably find it in some history books, but I had the luck of going to Kentucky last year and it was just some of the books that I was reading about Kentucky while I was there. And it did say that the name Kentucky is an Iroquois word named after those who conquered the people there. And the theory is when we came back to the northern frontier of our territory, meaning St. Lawrence area, when we established Gundagai in 1667, 1668, that really opened up an unimpeded access to the Great Lakes area for the Haudenosaunee. And that's when we made our way as far as Gundagai. And some people will say, well, we might have not been the most diplomatic in our approach to dealing with our Hoonga peoples out west.
I don't see where that's coming from.
and in making it as far as what is present day Kentucky, some theories are that the name Kentucky was named after the people who conquered them, meaning the people of Gandage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this idea around hinges, you know, it's like it's that first glimpse into our people really taking on their technology and applying it into our households and into our lives and looking at how does it fit into our way of life. And as you start to look, even during Sullivan's raids into our territory back during the revolution, the soldiers were commenting how the Haudenosaunee households were so well furnished, even more well furnished than the Europeans.
Yeah.
You know, so this is even starting back in the 1630s that we were starting to take their technology and choosing what we wanted to apply into our homes.
It's all about efficiency. You know, I'm sure they looked at it and said, this iron hinged door with a plank door is more efficient than a bearskin.
More efficient, won't need as much maintenance on the door, etc., etc. Saves me a lot of time that I can spend, you know, doing whatever, you know. And that's really interesting. And now, of course, later on, you get into that whole discussion. These are things that our people looked at and made, like you said, conscious decisions. And then later, some other things start coming in, and maybe we don't always see. They don't always see how those things are going to impact other things, you know, the use of weapons, guns, and so on. I'm sure we can talk about later. But
I'll follow it up. I'll follow it up because this is kind of related. A couple of days after they go to this village that I kind of just described, they go to another castle. They go to another fortified village. And it says in there that, again, I hear it has the number of houses, 16 houses, 50, 60, 70, 80 steps long, and one 16 steps, which sounds like a small cabin. And here's the important part. And one of 5 steps in which a bear was being fattened. It had been there almost 3 years and was so tame, it ate everything we had given it. So really what the implication is that
we rode bears into battle, right?
Well, the implication is that we had livestock.
Yeah.
Right.
And in this case, we were raising a bear to be slaughtered at some point, you know, and, I mean, that's, I guess the implication by saying that they're fattening it up, you know, and,
that's pretty clear. That's what they're doing. And
there was in these records and stories, they would say that if it was a bear cub, you know, they would take it and then they would raise it, fatten it. And at a certain time in its life when it was old and fat, you know, they would slaughter it.
Like,
take the meat, the oil, for ceremonial purposes too. You know, when we talk about our moon dance that the women do, they talk today, they would use a pig head, right? Yeah. But a long time ago, they said it was a bear's head that they would use to make
symbolize the moon.
And so just that link that, and who knows, maybe that's what they were fattening this bear up for back in 1630s.
Part of it anyway. For sure. That's really an interesting observation, I have to say.
What I think is significant about it is, I'm going to go back to like when I was in grade 10 history. Not with you, Harley, though. I'm talking about when I was at Centennial. When I was at Centennial, we had to take the provincial grade 10 history course. And I remember getting into a little bit of a debate with my teacher where he said that yous were horticulturists, yous weren't agriculturalists. And I said, well, what's the difference? And he said that, well, first, horticulture is not done with a plow. It's not plow technology. And that there's no livestock that's involved. Well, in looking at this little excerpt, I'm sure it's accurate. But it would dismiss that whole claim that we were merely horticulturalists and that we were agriculturalists because we raised livestock even back then. So I think that's a significant distinction.
That is important, I think. And that's interesting. Horticulture, agriculture.
Interesting debate there.
All right. Here's another one.
Okay.
December 23rd. A man came shouting and screaming through the longhouse that they're in. However, we did not know what it was supposed to mean. After a while, Geronimus Delacroix came in and wondered what it meant that the Indians were arming themselves. I asked them what was meant by it, and they said it was nothing against me and that, quote, we are going to go play with one another. There were four with clubs and some with axes and sticks, so that there were 20 men under arms, 9 on one side and 11 on the other. Then they went at it, fighting each other, fighting and striking. Some wore helmets, which were made out of, which they made themselves from thin reeds and cord woven together, so that no arrow or axe could penetrate or cause serious injury. Armor and helmets.
So what does that sound?
A nice sparring session out there, right?
Well, that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing.
Probably.
They're training. They were training these warriors. Mm. Yeah.
Why, do you think it sounds like something else?
He would have mentioned a ball or anything. If it
I think there lacrosse, is a reference yeah. later that they play a game that's yeah. it's lacrosse, yeah. but it's I what they're doing. I think is they're training, and it scared the hell out of these three guys that when they saw this happening. But I think in terms of material culture, mm-hmm. I always thought what was really interesting is that they had armor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we don't really hear of or see of.
Yeah, we talk about
later
it.
On.
Well, the Europeans try to picture us running around with absolutely nothing on, pretty much, and breech cloths all the time. Yeah. And, you know, even though we know it's an area where, you know, you have some cold temperatures, and but that's, you know, they come in with a certain view that these people are whatever lacking
it,
in.
It would make sense,
clothes.
Though. I mean, maybe prior to the European arrival, maybe they did have some sort of armor that they used that to protect themselves.
I have seen an illustration of a Huron warrior in woven reed armor, and it was pretty cool to see, but I think that was one of the only references I ever saw. Mm-hmm. There's also a possibility that because they were training, that's why they wore this stuff.
Sparring gear.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah,
maybe it's their sparring gear.
Yeah, you want to get injured for the real deal.
You know, as like the rippling effect of having the Europeans when we were starting to engage with them in battles, after a while you start to see the disappearance of palisaded villages because there was no use for them with the cannons and the muskets, so they started to abandon palisades. So I'm sure that even with this armor, they were seeing, well, it's kind of useless to be putting all this time and effort into making this flimsy armor when these guns are and so you start to see their tactics adapting to fighting with the Europeans using their weaponry and being more hit and run type and, you know,
so
being
stealth.
Bare minimum, like you were saying, with breech clots and painted up and the like.
And using those tactics and saying we're not going to be obviously going out in the middle of a field like the Europeans would fight battles and stuff and wearing red and wearing blue and bright blue and shooting at each other. Instead, it's saying, like, you know, we can't do that. Maybe we felt we could have at the beginning.
Yeah.
But now saying we have to use a little bit more tactical approach if we're going to engage in any kind of conflict.
Yeah. No, I'm sure that this armor wouldn't have been able to stop a musket ball. No. Yeah. But it makes me think of people are familiar with the Tuscarora scholar Hewitt, J.N.B. Hewitt. Mm-hmm. He wrote a paper once on the meaning of the word Rodisco Hargete, and his theory is that the root word was oscure for hemp, and because hemp was used to weave mats. Mm-hmm. So what his theory was is that it's recorded that when warriors were on the warpath or hunting, that they would always have a coiled up or rolled up mat with them. For sitting, for sleeping, it had a lot of purposes. Mm-hmm. But what they would do is they'd kind of roll it up and put it over their shoulder, hence Rodisco Hargete. But in that paper, he does talk about what the average warrior took with them on the warpath, and it was a satchel of cornmeal or our kind of corn, which you could probably use to make mush with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they would have their weapons, but they'd also have this mat so they could make a home anywhere that they went.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting conversations we had at the Great Law that one summer, when we had some of the guys sitting around talking about this word, because, you know, it kept coming up in the Great Law retelling of
what
the
story. What
does it mean? And then a group of us got together, you know, all speakers and well-versed in our culture and history, and then we all got into different discussions about what we heard growing up from our old timers. And the interesting thing from one of our Oneida brothers was, he says, well, he had heard this word was translated to it's like the ochre. Describing
the red ochre
that they would put onto their shoulders and on their heads to signify if they were going to war, mm-hmm. they would have themselves painted, right? Mm-hmm. And then even some of the guys would even put the red ochre on their shirts. Yeah. And so it was kind of like they're carrying the ochre with them.
Like rust?
Yeah, almost like a rust color. Rust.
Yeah.
And then another one of our Seneca brothers said, well, for them, it was talking about the mat, but he even went further to say that we used to have these war mats, these war bundles, mm-hmm. that specific guys in the war party would be like the designated keeper of that bundle, that mat. And before they would engage in a battle, they would unroll this mat and there would be all sorts of like, today they call them charms and things like that, mm-hmm. right? But they were like these special gifts that had been in battle with their ancestors that were carried. And so it was like these objects. So they would hand one to Harley. They would hand one to Deweza. They would hand one to me and to others. And it's like each one had a special significance and like a quote unquote power that it carried, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you had this, it's like you were endowed with this, the power of this object, right? And then even they had tattooing bundles where they would specially tattoo things on certain warriors. So like there was that mat that they talked about. And they said it was such a powerful bundle and mat that it's like that's what they were carrying too was and so that was another description of Rodiscardagete is they were carrying that.
That's really interesting. Well,
what's funny is in the Jesuit Father Lafitau, the Jesuit who spent time here in Ganawaga in maybe 1715 up to maybe 1717, he asks that question of the people, what does it mean Rodiscardagete, other than that it refers to the men. His answer from the people he asked here was that word is so old, the meaning of it has been lost to obscurity.
Even then they were debating, even what then. Does this even mean? You know? Like,
Yeah.
Wow.
So I got another, I got another part here. Okay. This is taking place on December 31st, New Year's Eve, 1634, going into 1635. And it says here that they have already made their way to the Oneida village. And here's what it says. I'll just say this first. Throughout the whole, you know, couple of weeks that they, until they got to this point, almost every village they stop at, the people there say, Asarundade, Asarundade, meaning to shoot their guns. Because at this time we weren't armed with the muskets.
Rare to see it.
It would have been rare to see it. Yeah. I'm sure in the decades that came, it became a more common thing to have in the villages. Yeah. But it was almost like it was a special thing for them, especially to see them shoot it. Yeah. So almost every village has asked them to shoot. On this particular occasion, which is again New Year's Eve, it says here that evening. We fired 3 shots in honor of the year of our Lord and Redeemer, Jesus Christos. So, shooting guns on New Year's Eve back in 1634.
It wasn't our people doing it, but I'm sure they wanted to right there.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we had heard in reading and looking into it was this was around the time we had our New Year.
Yeah,
you know, in winter time, and there would be a yell that they would have. They would cry out to let people know that now is the time for our New Year. You know, they would send out certain runners or messengers to yell. And as time went on, they started to say, "Well, let's make louder noise to call attention to everybody." So they would shoot the gun off at New Year's to let everybody know, "Gather up, now's the time." You know, so this idea of shoot. I mean, I know there is a campaign
to, like, to
stop
to
that in our community. So we're kind of not saying like you know, stick it to the man or anything. Yeah, but this is something that was in our history. But being that, you know, we have a lot more houses now, you know, you got to be more careful with how we do that.
Well, it's like anything; you have to have to adapt to what's going on around us. We make our own decisions, but that's.
I can't say if that's when a tradition like that started. I'm just saying that it caught my eye. It caught my eye that in 1634 on New Year's Eve that these Dutch guys come into one of our villages and shoot guns on New Year's.
Well, the Dutch guys, as you say, were doing the shooting. Mm-hmm. It was something that they saw as something to celebrate.
Yeah.
And who knows, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, it may have passed on. It may not. We don't know that.
Mm-hmm. And I was surprised when I heard that other communities do it aside from us, like in Tonawanda. Yep. They do that. And
they shoot the gun off at New Year's.
But New Year's Eve, I'm talking about. But for midwinter, I think shoot a shotgun or something. Yeah. I think it's just one shot or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe that's tied in exactly to what you said. Yeah. You said they on you, our midwinter, they would yell. Some guy would yell. But as you said, the communities got bigger. Mm-hmm. It was maybe a call to this was or signal everyone. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't yell loud enough, you know. And the community spread out. Communities got people changed their residency in terms of no longer living in the longhouses and that whole, you know, moving to those nuclear or those single family units. Mm-hmm. Now they got to reach everybody. Hey, makes sense to signal everybody, remind everybody, whatever it is.
This was pre-Facebook too.
So. Yeah.
Something that just caught my eye. It wasn't a part that I was intending to read off, but this is the following day on January 1st, where it says here,
please don't say they were all hungover.
No. But it says, an Indian once again told us we were scoundrels. And as previously told, he was very malicious to William Thomason, who became so angry that the tears ran from his face.
What had they done? Yeah.
I just says that there's some people in the village that aren't really happy that they're there. It sounds like the leadership, for lack of a better word, are being very inviting and being very diplomatic, but there are some people who aren't too crazy about them being there. And there's a part where the other guy that's with them, his Geronimus Delacroix, keeps whispering to the author of the journal, Van der Bogart, saying, one of the Indians told me that he's going to stab me with a knife. And anyway, it seems like really consistent throughout this book that this Geronimus thinks that they're all out to get him. Mm-hmm. So who knows? It might be just him being scared.
It could be, but again, this is not their first encounter with Europeans.
Yeah.
We're not talking, if you really go back from that, our people had maybe, as I said, they established themselves in the Manhattan area, and then later put Fort Orange up there, coming closer. And I'm sure our people, as we had said earlier, had been in that area. Maybe events had happened, encounters had happened, positive and negative.
Well, yeah. I'm sure one of the things that was a major factor was they talk about as the Europeans were moving up onto the eastern coast, the spread of diseases was vast.
Yes.
And so even just coming into contact with them was like, you know, you could get sick. They bring the sickness with them. And this is what's been happening. Yeah. Numbers were dwindling, even at that time.
Yeah.
So estimates are even, really, really.
Even before we had met with Europeans, 50%. They says we were already being hit by these unknown diseases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's two interesting things there. One is in the beginning of this book, there's a couple of ethnologists that share some information when they compile a lot of the data that's in the journal. And it seems like by this point in 1634, we had just ended a long conflict with the Algonquin. Mm-hmm. And it says in there that we lost half of our population at this point to warfare and diseases. Mm. So smallpox specifically. Yeah. And that definitely already 1634, and we lost half of our population. So we're already dealing with
our people, who knows how many from the time of the really first contact with people who had contacted them. Mm-hmm. You know, the people along the coast, as we say, some of those were 50 years before, 70 years before, had been wiped out largely by diseases. And there's some estimates in some of the books I've read, and some areas 90% plus of the population. Devastating. And who's to say how it affected us?
Yeah.
How
much one of the numbers that they throw out that has to do with both North and South America. Mm-hmm. And again, they can't know for sure, but an estimated number was that there was upwards of 16 million people that were inhabiting this part of the world. Mm-hmm. And they says, and then by the 1900s, it was down to a few hundred thousand.
I've heard even larger more than numbers that, in the 60 million type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That, in all the Americas, Turtle Island and South America, that there are upwards of those areas numbers.
So for those of you who are just joining us, we're well into our conversation already, talking about some historical tidbits going back to the 1600s. And We are in episode 6 of this limited series, which is a 10-part series, and we have in studio Harley Delaron and Deweza de Deer, and we're just going over some of the historical things that were happening in the Mohawk Valley back in the 1600s. And being that we're already short on time, I think we have enough time maybe to look at one more section, and then we'll wrap up the conversation from there.
Well, since we were talking about sickness and disease, this one's gonna probably we could probably spend a whole show just on this one. Mm-hmm. But basically, I think I mentioned earlier that Vander Bogart himself was a doctor, and there's two different occasions while he's on this journey where he's asked to visit with a sick person. Mm. I didn't mark off the first one, but the first one, they bring him into one of the smaller villages, and I think the way they interpret it is they're having a ceremony to get rid of the devil in this. That's one, again, when I was saying earlier that we have to use our own critical thinking when we look at this information to see what, look at it from their eyes and look at it from our eyes. We kind of know what they're talking about. Where these guys, it's probably a shock to them. But in that ceremony that they do for them, it says that they drink some kind of medicine, and then they regurgitate it and vomit onto the sick person. And so people might be familiar with
some good old Red Willow, right?
That's what that does. or Bear Dance.
Yeah,
it could be Bear Dance that they're doing. Mm-hmm. In this one, it's a little bit more specific in the details. They go to one of the bigger villages, and they again ask Vander Bogart to go in and see that they're going to have this ceremony to, again, I'm not making up the term, but they're going to try to exorcise the devil from this sick person. So here's what it says. I took Geronimus with me. When we arrived, the floor of the house was completely covered in tree bark over which the devil hunters were to walk. They were mostly old men who were all colored or painted with red paint on their faces because they were to perform something strange. Three of them had garlands around their heads upon which there were five white crosses. These garlands were made out of deer hair, which were dyed with the roots of herbs. In the middle of the house was a very sick person who had been languishing for a long time. And there sat an old woman who had an empty turtle shell in her hands, in which were beads that rattled while she sang. Here they intended to catch the devil and trample him to death, for they stomped all on the bark of the house to pieces so that none remained. It goes on a little bit more. I'll kind of skip more to the end, but it says that other men then ran. It talks about an otter, that they have an otter that it's almost like they're sucking the poison out of this man and spitting it into the mouth of an otter, which I cannot equate to anything that I'm familiar with anyway. Mm. But at the end, it says that it was a wonder to see. Indeed, they threw fire, ate fire, and threw around hot ashes and embers in such a way that I ran out of the house. So what does that sound like?
Yeah, that sounds like something that we still carry with today, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not to go delve too far into part of the conversation, but you know, we have our medicine societies that still continue to this day.
Yeah.
You know? And
so you can see the similarities. Yeah. You can see the similarities.
Yeah. Going all the way back to the 1600s into what we're still continuing today.
Yeah.
And that's why I was saying earlier in the show that it's fascinating to see that no matter what has happened to us, there's still these links back to even going to the 1600s. Yeah. Of who we are.
And that's the thing about history. In the first episode, we talked about that, about why study history. Mm-hmm. And then you look at that, and you can make some of those links and see that there's continuity that there is. You look back at it and say, how are we the same and how have we evolved? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a lot of ways, we still are the same. And it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because even talking with some of our old timers who said, even though we were such a heavily Christianized community, there were still all of these things that we still maintained in our community. You know, a lot of things that they said, our clan system, our way of governance, which was adapted up here in the north. You know, a lot of things, death feasts and medicine things that happened for a time was underground. But these were things that survived through even colonization because, you know, it was our choice after a time to live the way we wanted to live. But then it was also enforced upon us from the outside to try to do away with all this stuff. But we still have it today. And we can look back to say we've carried it on this long, even going further back than the 1600 journal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So any final thoughts from the two guests?
I just want to say that just a real quick note on in this journal, it might be the first reference that we ever see to the word Ganushuni in this book. It appears so you know, we're familiar with Hodinushuni. People will say it means people of the longhouse or people of the extended house. If you look back, you know, there's a lot of different incarnations of the word Rodinushuni, Hodinushuni, Ganushuni. But it seems in the older documents, you see Ganushuni a little bit more prevalent. The reason I say this is because I have had heard recently that people suggesting that Ganushuni is a new word,
it's a new term
to describe the Confederacy. But it's well documented, even going back to 1634, that we refer to ourselves as the extended house, Ganushuni.
My final thoughts is I just really enjoyed this this period and this time. I've learned a lot myself too and tried to do. But I mean, I want to thank both of you for interacting and helping me to be part of this. And it's very interesting. You always learn.
It's been a really good three episodes, you guys. You know, the past 3 weeks have been really, it's been really good conversations and discussions that we've had. And maybe, you know, if this is something we pick up back next year, we can pick up more of the conversation or sometime we can try to get out there more to discuss more of these, you know, parts in history and everything. But again, I want to say Nyawa for coming in a third time and to add to this 10-part limited series that we have going. And you know, just to keep up the good work once again. And always I like to send that encouragement out to people who are working in the areas of keeping our history alive, you know, keeping it going, and that they just continue to do that work. So now we'll go to our two guests who came in tonight. And up next, we have Old Fish Dance, and we'll be right back after that.